Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, a romance novel that takes readers back to Clear Lake in the 1940s. But first, we're going to go much farther back in time. He's been dead for over 400 years, but we still turn to the words and work of William Shakespeare for wisdom and inspiration, particularly when it comes to matters of love. The English language has changed a lot over the last four centuries, so decoding the language of Shakespeare can be a challenge. My next guest has not only decoded Shakespeare's language, he's translated it into modern poetry. In his book, Shakespeare's Sonnets Retold, Classic Love Poems with a Modern Twist, he's rewritten every one of Shakespeare's sonnets, following the rules of rhyme and iambic pentameter, but using modern, accessible language. And he is with me now via Skype. Hello, James Anthony.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, when did you first encounter Shakespeare's sonnets?
Well, I think probably like most people, I came across them first at school as a school kid. And of course, they pop up throughout your lives, and there was a number of the more famous of his sonnets. Obviously, Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's Day is probably one of Shakespeare's, it's probably his second most famous line after to be or not to be. And so you sort of come across them through your lives, and occasionally you'll hear one read out at a wedding and so forth. But I guess I was probably about 15 when I first heard my first sonnet.
Right, and what did you think of them when you were 15?
I didn't really understand them, like most kids when it comes to Shakespeare when you first start. And they certainly didn't resonate with me. And when I was 15, I thought it would have, if someone had said I would rewrite all 154 of them, I think I probably would have said you were completely crazy.
Well, and you didn't pursue an English PhD. I mean, this is not your course of study that you chose with life. You were working, you had your own business, a tech business, right?
I did indeed, yes. I was very much on the tech side going through school. I was very sort of more technical into maths and physics and those sort of things rather than the English language. I didn't really study it at beyond 16. I sort of gave it up as soon as I could. And I moved on and I set up a technology business, and that's what brought me to the US seven years ago now, nearly 8 years ago. But I always had in the back of my mind this sort of love of poetry and the sort of the beauty of expressive words and the power of using words as this form to communicate particularly emotions of the heart and love and all those good things. And so it sort of, that was always bubbling at the background. And I sort of thought one day maybe I'll pursue poetry, but I used to write it from a personal consumption, personal pleasure, but I never published it. And so this was my first piece of published work.
And what brought you back to Shakespeare's sonnets? Was there some sort of experience that made you think, I really want to dig into this work?
Well, it's a great question. I think the older style of poetry tended to stick to the format of iambic pentameter, the format of rhythm, the format of rhyme. And if you look at a lot of the modern poetry, it tends to be a lot more freestyle and a lot more just improvised, and it flows like a collection of words. And that's all well and good, and a lot of people get a lot of pleasure from that. For me, it doesn't really resonate. But what I really like my words to do, I like my words to beat out a rhythm, to drive along, and you know what's coming in terms of the structure. And that comes from iambic pentameter. It comes from the structure of a sonnet, which is 14 lines consisting of three quatrains, four lines which alternately rhyme, three quatrains, and then a final couplet which rhymes together. And so with that, that sort of drew me back into Shakespeare's sonnets. And it's like a pop song. It beats along like a, and I've always loved rock and roll, and I've always loved the music, but I've never been able to sort of write and sing and perform. But that sort of drew me back to this, to the beauty of the of the meter, of the cadence, of the words as they sort of roll off your tongue when you spit them out. And that drew me back to Shakespeare originally. But it always left me frustrated a little bit as to what he was talking about, because not only, as you said at the top of the conversation, not only is the language 400 years old, he also had a very special way, which we all still love today, very special way of expressing emotions in complex ways, in ways that were complex even 400 years ago. And so to be able to interpret that and understand really from the get-go just by reading it is really very, very difficult. And people who are perhaps not used to poetry and certainly not used to Shakespeare's language will struggle with it, just like I always did, and I always continue to do, in truth. But it was that challenge that sort of drew me into it. And one day I just thought, well, let me see if I can rewrite one of these in a way, in the poetic form that I like to write in, which is the structured iambic pentameter, but in a way that I could understand, in language that that would make sense to me. And so the way that I did that I would dissect the line by line and understand precisely what he's talking about, understand what the imagery meant, understand what the sentiment he was trying to express was, and then try to convey it in a direct line for line translation, respecting the 5 beats per line of iambic pentameter and the rhyming structure of the quatrains and the final couplet, and that's what I did, and that sort of got me started, and it kind of went from there.
So when you went to decode these poems, other people have done it over the years, not in the way that you've done it, but other people have certainly broken them down and explained what the poetry is about. Did you go to those other sources or did you start from scratch?
I always went to all of those other sources, because I would read a sonnet whenever I was translating one. I would read them and I go, well, that's lovely, but I still don't really know what he's talking about. And so I would have to go and do my research around it. And I would read, there's an awful lot that has been written about the sonnets. And there's an intense amount of interrogation of every single word that he's written. And people have got views on it. By and large, the critics agree on what the sentiment is expressed. And it's usually, I would say probably 9 times out of 10, they agree 100%. Probably 10% of the time, there is dubious or various different types of interpretations of the sentiment that Shakespeare was expressing. And when that happened, I would then need to make my own interpretation of what was being said, and express it in the way that aligned with what I believed William Shakespeare was writing about. So, but yes, I would absolutely refer back to all the text. And as you say, it has been done, and it's been written in many different forms where people would sort of write and explain what the lines mean. But it hasn't been done in a format where we respect the iambic pentameter and the exact structure of every single line that he wrote.
So you thought, okay, I'll try this. I'll try rewriting some of Shakespeare's sonnets and you know, use the same structure and all of that. What made you think, I'm going to rewrite every single one of Shakespeare's sonnets?
Well, it's a bit, it sort of got quite contagious, if I'm quite honest, because I started, when I did Sonnet 18, I thought, well, I'll try another one. And then I went to Sonnet number one, and I did that. And then I did a third one, and then I did a fourth one. I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the process. Some people like to do crosswords. Some people like to do Sudoku. I like rewriting the sonnets, but it would take me a long time. Each line, sometimes it would take me a couple of hours to write just 4 lines of poetry. So it was quite a big task. But, you know, once I'd written 5 of them, I thought, well, you know, there's 154 of these. It's really almost certainly impossible to do in a lifetime. But it sort of came across my mind. And then in 2016, I was fortunate enough to be able to take a sabbatical from work. Took a year off, and this became my job, and this became my day job. And I would sit at my desk. I'd be sat at my desk at 7 a.m. every morning, and I wouldn't leave until I'd had the sonnet written. And I'd realized that if I did one a day for a year, I would have them done. And that's precisely what happened. It took me about 10 months in total, and I really focused it and worked very hard at it. Some of them took just a few hours to do. Others were extremely difficult and would take 8-10 hours to do. But I don't think I ever had a day where I didn't actually get one finished.
Wow. Well, and all right, you say that became your day job, but nobody was paying you to do this at this point. You didn't have a book contract when you started this. So job or obsession?
Well, definitely an obsession. And it was it was a sort of relaxation. And when people retire, they often say, well, you know, some people get very bored. And I took this year off to sort of decompress from 13 years of running my own business. And this was a complete change. And it was kind of just what I needed in my life. And I wrote some other books as well during that process. And I really just learned to love the power of poetry, learned to love the discipline of writing a sonnet, learned to love telling stories in some of the other books that I'd written, and it was just a wonderful experience, and I was very lucky. But as you say, I didn't have a book, I didn't have a book deal, I didn't have an agent, and you know, to get a decent book deal, you need to have a decent agent, and I didn't have any of those. And but I thought, well, I sort of believed in the project that I was doing. I knew that the interpretations that I'd written were, you know, had some merit, and I was always very pleased with them. They were varying quality. Sometimes I would read them, I go, yeah, that's great, I'm really pleased with it. Other days I'd bang the table and I'd shout out, I'd say, that's absolutely fantastic, and I'd be absolutely thrilled with them. So I knew I was new, if only for my own sake, I knew I was doing something. And I was in the fortunate position where I could just work towards finishing this project and see where it would take me. And then And then when it was finished, I sent it around to some agents and eventually got signed.
Did you tell people that you were doing this?
I did. And most people thought I was, I don't know, mad, but no one really kind of got it. And I remember even when I finished, I sort of said, I said to a few friends down the pub, I said, you know, I've done something that I'm quite proud of. And I said, I finished rewriting all the sonnets. And they were like, oh, well, that's great, well done, and went on talking about football again. So it was, people weren't really very interested. But I enjoyed it, and I did it for myself, and it's taken me further than I really thought it might.
I'm talking with James Anthony. He has rewritten all of Shakespeare's sonnets and published them. Shakespeare's Sonnets Retold, Classic Love Poems with a Modern Twist. And we will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is James Anthony, and he has taken all of Shakespeare's sonnets, 154 of them, read them, interpreted them, and recreated them in modern English. His book is Shakespeare's Sonnets Retold, Classic Love Poems with a Modern Twist. And in rewriting all of Shakespeare's sonnets, he stayed true to the rules of rhyme and the iambic pentameter. And I think, James, we should, before we kind of dig into this collection of sonnets and talk about what it tells us about Shakespeare, I think we should experience one of your poems. And this is from early in the collection, not the most famous sonnet. Let's save that just for a little while longer. But why don't we take a look at sonnet number 12? And why don't I'll read four lines, you read your four lines, and then we'll all have an idea of how you have turned this work into something so much more accessible for all of us. All right?
Fantastic. Okay. Sounds like a good
this
plan.
This is sonnet number 12. When I do count the clock that tells the time and see the brave day sunk in hideous night, when I behold the violet past prime and sable curls all silvered o'er with white.
Now when I watch the clock in contemplation, observing twilight slip to gloomy night, or see a flowering violet's degradation, its purple petals crumbling to white.
When lofty trees I see barren of leaves, which erst from heat did canopy the herd, and summer's green all girded up in sheaves, borne on the bier with white and bristly beard.
When leaves of towering trees fall to the ground, which formerly kept sheep and cattle cool, and summer's crop is harvested and bound with bearded barley pulled by cart and mule.
Then of thy beauty do I question make, that thou amongst the wastes of time must go, since sweets and beauties do themselves forsake and die as fast as they see others grow.
Then I begin to ponder on your beauty, for you are going to die and won't return. For all fine things will die, as is their duty, observing others grow as they adjourn.
And nothing against time's scythe can make defense, save breed to brave him when he takes thee hence.
There's nothing you can do to make time stop, unless you breed before you face the chop.
That last line is perfection.
Well, thank you.
So let's talk about these sonnets, because I'll be honest, I knew sonnet number 8, shall I compare these to A Summer's Day, but I don't think I've really looked deeply into any of the others. And starting to look through the collection, the first thing that I find is that most of the first sonnets, all of the first sonnets, are really just telling me that I need to procreate over and over again. You must have children or you're wasting your life. So tell me what this collection represents for William Shakespeare.
Well, it was very interesting. And I was much like you when I approached this. I didn't really know much about them. I knew there were poems, but I certainly didn't know the detail of the themes throughout them. But sonnets number 1 to 17, as you rightly describe, they are called, or they get called, the procreation sonnets, because they urge this young man to reproduce in order that his bloodline will continue. And the identity of the young man is not known, but he is typically called the fair youth. And then from sonnets 18 to 126, William Shakespeare is having a relationship with this man. And that really caught me off guard, because I didn't expect it. And it was quite clear that sonnets 18 to 126 are love poems that address a relationship, and a very intense relationship, between William Shakespeare and this young aristocratic man whose identity is not known but is assumed widely to be Henry Wriothesley, the third Earl of Southampton. But there are have been other people who have been suggested. So that is the body of the work all the way up to sonnet 126. But then from 127 to 152, Shakespeare is having a bawdy, really quite a lustful relationship with a dark-skinned lady who history has termed the Dark Lady. And she's most definitely got dark skin. She's got quite likely she's a Moor from North Africa at the time, because London, when he was living there, was an active port, so people were from all over. But it's very clear in all of those, on all that sequence, that he's having this really tempestuous relationship with this woman. And then there's two more. There's the last two sonnets at the end of the sequence, which are sort of Greek mythology. But by and large, that's the gist of it. There are these two main characters that dominate this sequence, I believe that this is what William Shakespeare was doing. This was his diary. I believe this is the sonnets are the diary of his heart, and we do not know anything about William Shakespeare, about his life. We barely know where he was. We don't know what day he was born. We don't know his movements. We have no personal interviews. We have no record of any letters he ever sent to anybody. There was really nothing about him. Yet we feel like we know William Shakespeare because we've grown up with him. We've grown up with these great plays that intertwine our lives, that intersect everything we know. So everyone knows about Hamlet. Everyone knows about Romeo and Juliet. He created those plays for a living. These sonnets he wrote in his downtime, And they were published in 1609. And there's a strong argument to say that he didn't authorize them, because there's no proof that William Shakespeare authorized these. And this was right towards the end of his life. You know, he was to die 7 years later. And W.H. Auden, in his assessment of it, he said he believed William Shakespeare would have been mortified when he found out that these sonnets were published, because they reveal this about him. But it, to me, it's not really a surprise. But just going back 400 years, it was sacrilegious. It was illegal to have these type of relationships. He was having a homosexual relationship. He was having a relationship, a mixed race relationship, all the whilst he was married with three children, latterly two children, because his only son died. And when you study it, and when you learn about it, you can see the ebbs and flows in these relationships, and just the way that anyone who's ever written poems, if you try writing poetry and you write it from your heart, if you've had your heart broken, your poems are sort of, the words just fall out of you. And that's exactly what William Shakespeare was doing. So I felt that this was, a revelation really to me. And people have been uncomfortable to accept that for 400 years. And I think that fortunately we're now living in a time where you're open to love who you want to love and be who you want to be. And I think that we're at that point in time where we can accept William Shakespeare for who he was. And my hope is that that people can access some of these words of Shakespeare, some of these poems that he was expressing, read into the frustrations that he was having in his life, because this was clearly, I believe, he was having a very difficult life. And remember, he got his wife Anne Hathaway pregnant when he was only 17 years old, and she was 8 years older than him. And that was a really big difference. It's a big difference today. It was a much bigger difference in those days when life expectancy was about 45. He raised his family and then said, "Sorry, I'm leaving. I'm going to London." And he basically left his wife and kids to grow up in Stratford without him. I just think it all sort of holds together as a cohesive story when you can get into the heart of it. I spent a year basically with William Shakespeare's diary, and I have no axe to grind about this. I'm just a straight middle-aged guy who enjoys writing poetry, and this sort of message fell out of it, and it was a revelation for me, and good on him. And I think it was one of those things that I hope people will come to accept about him.
I'm talking with James Anthony. He's just published the book Shakespeare's Sonnets Retold, Classic Love Poems with a Modern Twist. And he has rewritten all of Shakespeare's sonnets with the same kind of rhyme scheme, the same kind of iambic pentameter, but in modern language. And I think we should read sonnet number 18. This is the one that even if you've never read Shakespeare's sonnets, you know at least a line of sonnet number 18. So we'll do the same thing we did before. I'll read four lines and then you can read your four lines.
Okay.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date.
Shall I compare you to a summer's day? You're more delightful, always shining strong. High winds blow hard on flowering buds in May, and summer never seems to last that long.
Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometime declines, by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed.
Some days the sun is just too hot to bear, while other days it's stuck behind a cloud. For even gorgeous weather fades to fair, by chance, as Mother Nature is allowed.
But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou oust, nor shall death brag thou wanderedst in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growst.
But you, unlike the summer, will not fade, nor lose the love your face and soul defines. Not even death will make your life degrade, because your memory's captured in these lines.
So long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee.
So long as people breathe or eyes review, these words live on, reminding them of you.
What was it like to tackle that sonnet? I mean, again, that's the one that everyone knows. And you are translating it into language that makes it so much more clear. But although you're writing poetry, it's awfully hard to match the language of William Shakespeare.
Yeah. This was the first one I did, and I just approached it, and this was pretty much word for word. I changed a couple of words, I think, but by and large, this is what I wrote, and it was kind of liberating to go through this. And so, for example, you know, the fifth line, "Some time too hot, the eye of heaven shines." And when you first read that, I thought, it's nice. I'm not quite sure what is the eye of heaven. Of course, the eye of heaven is the sun. Sometime too hot, the eye of heaven shines. And so some days the sun is just too hot to bear, while other days it's stuck behind a cloud. So I tried to, and his line then is "and often is his gold complexion dimmed." So I tried to understand what he was talking about and then really simplify it, but also making sure that it was iambic. So some days the sun is just too hot to bear. Some days the sun is just too hot to bear, while other days it's stuck behind a cloud. So you keep that very tight cadence in the beat. And that was so the hardest thing with this is, well, one, understanding what he was talking about, and then two, matching the sentiment to a contemporary iambic pentameter sentence. And then probably the hardest component, once you got all of that, was getting the rhymes right. That would be very frustrating, because you get very close sometimes. You think, I'm nearly there. And sometimes you'd have to tear the whole thing up and start again, just because you just couldn't make a rhyme work. And words like, some words, you know, have got an awful lot of rhymes, and other words like love, for example. Love basically just rhymes with dove and above, and there's that. that's it. So you come to learn what you can, which words you can and cannot use at the end of the end of each sentence.
Now, these are love sonnets, but he wrote a lot about sex, and he used a lot of euphemisms. And when you translate into modern language, it becomes a lot less euphemistic. And we're not going to read any of those poems right now, because I think we'd have to put a warning before the show. But so in making something, taking something from euphemism to pretty much explicit, was that a difficult decision for you? I mean, those are things we, in poetry, we don't tend to write explicitly about.
Well, that's very interesting. I took the decision fairly early on to do that, because I thought about the context of how he was writing, and I thought about the era, and I thought, well, the time he was writing, he wouldn't have wanted, if anybody did see his poetry, he wouldn't have wanted it to be that explicit. I don't believe that he would have sworn as actively in that. I don't think he would have used, he sort of disguised a lot of his references, and they were very, very clear. But I think that my approach was, actually, we are living in a different era, and I think it's okay to say that. So when he was feeling, you know, sexually aroused about something, I would express it in a way that, the very direct way that we would now. And he would, he would perhaps shade over it. Or if he was very angry with somebody to the point of, wanting to shout at them, and we would swear at somebody. And he obviously didn't in the sonnets, but in my interpretation of it, I didn't hesitate to use a swear word where I believed he was metaphorically swearing. And so I also thought that he was a sort of a writer of the people. He would sort of speak to the people in the way that society spoke at that time. He wasn't a highbrow writer. That's why he was so popular. That's why his plays were so effective, because they worked for the people. And I wanted my poetry to have that sort of for the people edge, if you like, in a modern
context. A little bit of slang
context
every now and then. So we only have about a minute left. And you mentioned anger. That was one of the things that really struck me in the poems. A lot more anger and frustration than I expected to find. But for people who are coming to this collection and using your modern interpretations to actually understand what Shakespeare was writing about, what do you think you want people to take away from Shakespeare's sonnets?
I would like people to to appreciate the originals for what they were, and to get access to the originals, because this is a an absolutely beautiful body of work, but it's also incredibly overlooked for what it really is and for what it is. I mean, it's this greatest collection of love poems the world's ever known, albeit laced with heartbreak and pain and jealousy and anger and all those great things. But it's a, there's a great sort of story that runs through all this. So I would love people to be able to access that. And I also, as I said before, I believe this is his diary. This is him telling us who he really is as a man. And I just think this is the most overlooked and insightful body of work that we have for William Shakespeare. And I think that I would love it if just one person would drop me a line one day and say, you know what, I read your sonnets and they helped me understand a little bit about who this great man really was.
James Anthony, thank you so much.
My great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
James Anthony has just published Shakespeare's Sonnets Retold, classic love poems with a modern twist. He has rewritten every single one of Shakespeare's sonnets, maintaining the rhyme structure and the rhythm structure, but using modern, accessible language. I spoke with him via Skype. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. From 400-year-old romance to 60-year-old romance. Today's nasty weather sent us into the archives looking for an interview to finish out today's show, and we rediscovered my conversation with Loretta Ellsworth about a novel you could cozy up with to help you escape the gloom of this latest snowstorm. The book is Stars Over Clear Lake, and it takes readers back in time to Clear Lake, Iowa, and the Surf Ballroom during World War II. Loretta Ellsworth grew up in Mason City and now lives in Lakeville, Minnesota. And although she has published four young adult novels, this is her first book for adults. I asked her to start us off by reading a little bit of the book to give us an idea of what it's about.
Okay, well, it's a book that goes back and forth in time between the 1940s and 2007, and it follows this character, Lorraine, from when she's a teenager until she's in her late 70s. So I'm going to read a portion, maybe just of when it's a story of she's a farmer's daughter who lives near Clear Lake, and she meets a German prisoner of war who's working on her father's farm during the war while her brother is off fighting the Nazis. And so I'm going to read a part where she just meets this German prisoner of war the first time.
Okay.
In the 1940s. Okay. And her father has asked her to bring a basket of food to the prisoners. I cut through the thick grove of trees behind the barn, then stopped in my tracks, almost dropping the food. Right in front of me was a man. No, not a man. He was more of a boy, not much older than Pete. His blonde hair was messy, and he wore a sleeveless T-shirt stained with grass and dirt. I could see the outline of muscle through the shirt. His green jacket lay crumpled next to him. He was sitting against a haystack, smoking a cigarette, staring out at the field with a faraway look in his eyes. I took in a breath at the sight of the enemy right in front of me. I thought of turning back and running, but this was our farm. I couldn't hide forever. You'd best be careful or you'll burn down the farm, I said, remembering how Daddy warned us to be mindful where we burn trash. He jumped and almost dropped his cigarette, seemingly as spooked as by my presence as I'd been of his. He composed himself and looked at me as though I was a curiosity. Your cigarette, I said. He shrugged and kept on smoking. I imitated his smoking motion. He offered me a cigarette. I shook my head. No. He pointed to the cigarette. Verboten? Yes, whatever you said. Nine. No smoking, I said again, a bit louder. He pointed across the field where other workers were taking a break. Several of them were smoking too. We'll see about that. I walked on to find Daddy.
That's Loretta Ellsworth reading from her book Stars Over Clear Lake, a romance novel that takes place both in almost present day, in 2007, and back in the 1940s during World War II. A farm outside of Clear Lake, Iowa. A lot of the plot takes place at the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake. And Loretta, this is a landscape that you were very familiar with growing up because you grew up in Mason City. Tell me a little bit about the lore about the Surf Ballroom as you were growing up. What kind of role did that play in your childhood?
Well, for one, my parents had met at the Surf Ballroom. So there was that. And I attended the surf at concerts and dances many times when I was growing up. I knew, like most Earth Iowans, I knew how the Surf Ballroom was associated with Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Bopper, who played their last show there before their plane crashed just north of town. So I was aware of all that. I knew quite a bit about the surf.
And when did your parents meet there?
In the 1940s.
So that has a definite parallel to the plot in the novel, because the main character meets her husband at the Surf Ballroom in the 1940s. Was this inspired by your parents' romance?
It was. It was partly inspired by their romance. I know that I had often wondered how it would be for them, what it was like meeting for the first time and dancing at the Surf Ballroom. So that was partly inspired by that, yes.
Well, and I think about those years during the 1940s, big band music was, at its peak, and ballrooms like the Surf Ballroom, I mean, they were also really at their peak during the 1940s. Did your parents talk about what it was like to go hear a big band at the Surf?
They did a little bit, and also they've both passed away, but I also spoke to two of my aunts who went to the Surf Ballroom quite a bit. And one of the things that they both said was how lucky they felt to be able to see all these wonderful bands and singers, who were very famous, all of them played at the Surf.
Yeah, I mean, you write about some of them in the book as well, Jimmy Dorsey, and
right.
So many others made their way through Clear Lake, Iowa, as they toured around the country. This time, you read a little bit from the book featuring a German POW. That is another piece of Iowa history, that there was a camp for prisoners of war near Algona, Iowa. And those prisoners of war, those German prisoners of war, did do work on local farms. Was that a piece of history that you knew about when you were growing up in Mason City?
I knew about it because we would drive from our home in Mason City to visit our cousins who lived in Bancroft. And my father, on the drive, he always pointed out a sign in Algona that was near the airport that commemorates the POW camp that was there. It was torn down. And so we would stop once in a while, and he would make us read it.
So here's a little vindication for the dad that made you read the sign at the edge of the road.
Right.
Oh, that's wonderful. So as you have been a young adult novelist, and I know you also spent many years as a teacher, how long has this story been kind of cooking in your brain, putting together pieces from your childhood?
I know. I think stories, I don't think you always realize how long a story is. It was years ago that someone had mentioned that I should write about the POW camp. And at the time, I wasn't really interested, but I think, things stick in your head. And a mentor of mine says that we write behind our own backs, which I think is true. And I've always been intrigued by the Surf Ballroom. It's such a magical, mystical place on its own. And so it seemed that when I kind of wanted to write about the Surf Ballroom, but I couldn't find a way into that story. But then when I combined the POW camp with the Surf Ballroom, the story seemed to just sort of take off on its own.
Well, and I know that winter dance party really looms large for people when they think about the Surf Ballroom, which was really, although the Surf Ballroom is still a wonderful place to visit, that was kind of marked the end of the heyday for the Surf Ballroom and for the ballrooms that were all over Iowa. So was it kind of hard to get past that, which is that moment in history that looms so large in that part of the state?
It was. When I first thought about writing about the Surf, I thought it would be set in the time of the Buddy Holly in that time, because that is such an important part of the Surf history. But it didn't end up being in this story. But, you know, in the surf, you know, in the 1940s, there were over 2,000 ballrooms across the United States, and now it's less than 100, you know. So I knew that at one point the surf was almost torn down as well. So, you know, I wanted to write a story that would capture the magic of a place that had hung on through the years and survived, basically.
Well, and it almost didn't survive. In 1947, the surf ballroom burned down, which is something that plays an important role in the plot in your novel. And obviously, you've fictionalized that a little bit as well. And I'm not going to give any secrets away because there's a little mystery that is a thread throughout the novel that has to do with that. Do you remember when you learned about the surf burning down?
Well, actually, when I started writing the story, I had no idea that there was another surf. I didn't know that part of the history. And it wasn't until I started researching that I discovered that the surf had burned down in 1947 and it rebuilt across the street in 1948. So it actually had been on the lake itself at before that. So so that because of the fire, and as I researched it, they never really came up with a cause for the fire. So that kind of gave me some momentum in my present-day story and a little mystery, as you said.
Did you spend time in Clear Lake as you got inspiration for this story, doing research?
I did. I spent a lot of time at the Clear Lake Library in the History Center and at the Surf Ballroom. And so, you know, I did spend quite a bit of time there.
You also, this, as you mentioned, most of this takes place during World War II. The German POWs aren't the only part of real Iowa history that make an appearance in this. You also, the main character's brother, goes off to war. Mm-hmm. Was that a part of your family's experience? Again, were those stories that you heard about growing up?
They were. You know, my father fought in the war, and my father actually was German. He grew up in Iowa, but he was from a very large German family, and they spoke German at home. But he did fight for the United States Army during World War II. So there was that part of it, too, as well.
So did you draw on family stories when you were creating this relationship between your main character and her brother and the rest of the family?
Not particularly. I mean, I had heard lots of stories, you know, about the families, but I didn't have any relatives who had, I did have several relatives who fought in the war, in World War II, but I didn't draw on that as much. I think I grew up in the 1970s, so I drew a little bit more from the Vietnam War in personal inspiration for some of the story.
You're going to be doing a number of events around Iowa. I realize you're living in Lakeville, Minnesota, but you're going to be doing an event at the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake on Sunday, June 11th. What is it like to think about bringing the book to the surf?
Oh, it's wonderful. I mean, I can't imagine a better place to celebrate this book. There's also going to be a big band that plays afterwards. So how fun is that?
As the book has been released, I mean, obviously this isn't just for Iowa audiences. Now, as an Iowan reading the book and as somebody who's a little bit of a history buff, too, and I knew about some of these things, so it brought a lot of pieces together in one story that were close to my heart. So I can imagine a lot of Iowans will really enjoy that. But, of course, it's intended for people everywhere. Have you had any readers already who've been like, this almost seems far-fetched, this little part of Iowa who, you know, that touched so many parts of the world?
It does. And actually, my agent and my editor are both in New York. And, you know, we're kind of in flyover country here. So actually, we were doing some of the edits for the book, and I had mentioned to my editor that I wanted to stay as true as possible to the actual facts of what actually happened at the Surf Ballroom. And she said, "You mean that's a real place? I thought you made it up." I said, no. I said, it's a real place. And so she said, well, you have to include an author's note because people won't believe this. I said, yeah, okay. So I did.
Oh, that's funny because it's so easy to take it for granted here in Iowa.
Right.
Have you already gotten some response from people who maybe grew up in, I know the book's only been out a couple of weeks, but grew up in Mason City and the Clear Lake area?
I have. A friend of mine lives in Clear Lake and belongs to a book club. And she said of the seven women in her book club, one of them met their spouse at the surf ballroom. And so she says that they have verifiable fact that one in every seven Clear Lakers have met their spouse at the surf ballroom.
You'll need an author's note on that one,
right?
As well. So having written for young adults, what made you want to write a novel for adults?
Well, actually, the story itself sort of dictated it because of the fact that it goes back and forth in time and that she ages to be a woman in her late 70s. And I loved that part of the story as well, of her harboring this deep secret about the surf ballroom and the fire that destroyed it. And I liked her being able to reflect back. And I felt that the big band era, all of that would appeal to adult audiences more than young adults. Although I think young adults, you know, might enjoy reading this as well.
I was actually just going to say that. I could imagine, especially a teenager with connections to that area, really enjoying the book. And there's nothing in it. It's a romance novel, but there's nothing in it that would make me as a mother say, no,
right.
They shouldn't right. read that. What do you hope people take away from your story?
You know, I think ultimately it's a love story. So I think there's that, and just the little things that we don't realize that are happening right beneath our noses. Sometimes so many people are unaware of the POW camps and even the iconic surf ballroom. A lot of people in the country aren't aware of that too.
You mention a lot of different songs and music throughout the book as well, which led me to dig a little deeper into my playlist and listen to some music that I love. Are you hoping also that people maybe will get in touch with that part of our culture?
I do. I when I was doing research and listening to so many songs from that era, it was like, I really love this music. And I hadn't been a fan of it as much before, but I am now. So, yes, I hope that they do.
Well, Loretta, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Loretta Ellsworth is the author of the novel Stars Over Clear Lake. It's a romance novel that takes place in Clear Lake in the 1940s and also in 2007 as well. This conversation first aired in May of 2017. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Emily Woodbury, Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can get in touch with us anytime. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter @IowaPublicRadio. I'm there as well, @CharityNebby. And, of course, follow us on Facebook @IowaPublicRadio. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebby.